I have long been an ardent devotee of Bill Moyers' journal on PBS. How many of you watch Bill Moyers? Quite a few of you. His guests, it seems to me, almost always provide insightful, in-depth analysis on various aspects of our human condition. And it is analysis, I dare say, that we don't find very much of in the general media. And that's too bad. That's a critique, by the way. Often his programs challenge me immensely, but almost as often, his program leaves me with a mixture of fear about our collective future, a great deal of sadness that supposedly intelligent and caring people have allowed obscene suffering in our society and in our world at large, and a great deal of anger at the apparent indifference of politicians in both political parties to take definitive actions to rectify injustices that are blatant and far-reaching. A recent program had two experts in the field of child hunger and poverty addressing particularly the efforts by many in Congress to roll back or to completely eliminate programs that assist poor families and especially children. Repeatedly, they made the obvious argument that hungry children attending school find it difficult to learn. And it's obvious because when you're hungry, you really can't concentrate on much else. But that's only the tip of the iceberg, as they pointed out. Being hungry leads to malnutrition. Malnutrition leads to another set of problems, so that indeed futures are jeopardized. And the cycle of poverty continues. So that program provoked me to dig a little harder and more broadly into the whole area of poverty in America and its effects on our way of life. Along the way, I happened to have a discussion with a libertarian Tea Party friend of mine. As far as I know, he's the only Tea Party friend I have. I don't know, maybe some of you belong to the Tea Party. But he asserted rather strongly, to my astonishment, in the midst of a heated discussion about justice in America, that poor people ought to be thankful and consider themselves lucky because they are so much better off than poor people in other parts of the world. And I was somewhat incredulous, and I replied that unfortunately poor people in this country don't live in other countries, and so the comparison is all but meaningless. It cut absolutely no ice with him. He insisted. The U.S. Census Bureau in 2010, and I trust that their figures are extremely accurate, indicated that there are almost 47 million Americans living in poverty. It is the highest level in 52 years. In this, the richest nation on earth, there are 17 million households, nearly 15% of the population, who are what is termed food insecure. It's a fancy term for hunger. It, too, is the highest level ever recorded in our history. In addition, another nearly 7 million households have low food insecurity, meaning essentially that normal eating patterns are disrupted from time to time, usually coinciding with the cycles of the economic situation in the country. Not surprisingly, there is a racial, ethnic, gender component to poverty. Over 26% of Hispanics live in poverty. 27% of blacks. And within both of those groupings, the people who are hit hardest are generally single mothers and children. Those percentages are higher than the white population, even though in terms of raw numbers, there are more white people living in poverty than other groups. And finally, over 20 million people live in abject poverty, meaning that they are literally trying to survive day by day. Now you consider whether or not that is a scandal. It would be all too easy, I think, to become overwhelmed with the raft of statistics, and I have only scratched the surface here, that shed light on this basic issue. Yet I suspect that mere statistics very often obscure the deeper questions regarding the causes of poverty, causes that many people, not only those on the right, are unable and unwilling to look at very carefully or seriously. Perhaps the main culprit is an economic and political system which has rather systematically, and we are caught in one of those traps right now, tended to keep those who are poor in a continuous state of poverty. And my libertarian friend reflects precisely that attitude that tends to keep people there. A tax code which favors the wealthy, a minimum wage that Laura talked about that virtually ensures poverty, an expensive medical care system which we are addressing only slightly with Obamacare, but making a minor improvement, I think. All are offset. These programs are of minimal help for low-income families like those in the SNAP and WIC programs. Regarding the minimum wage, first of all, I have followed the drama, as maybe many of you have, going on in the District of Columbia with the City Council and their proposal that is on the table right now to enact a law requiring large employees of large establishments to pay a minimum wage of $15 an hour. That's making some real headway. Walmart, scheduled soon to build a number of new stores in the district, is promising to withdraw its plans if that legislation passes. I have a friend in politics. I think he's a friend. I've given him money several times. Bernie Sanders, who is a senator from Vermont. He is my favorite, most favorite curmudgeon. I love him. And he is outraged by Walmart's starvation wages and has pointed out accurately, I think, that Walmart has hoodwinked us long enough with its low prices on some items while at the same time paying its rank and file employees all across the nation with wages that are at subsistence level. And those same employees, and I happen to know a couple of them, need to in turn receive assistance from the government in order to survive. In other words, says Bernie Sanders, assistance programs are effectively supporting Walmart. We are, in effect, indirectly paying the world's largest corporation welfare. Now turn the page over and look at who owns and who profits from Walmart. Christy Walton, one of the Walmart clan people, widow of the late John Walton, is the richest woman in the world. Jim Walton is worth $23.7 billion. That's billion, not million, billion dollars. Alice Walton, $23.3 billion. Robson Walton, a mere $23.1 billion. That's more than Carl and I together make in a lifetime. Right? We're working on it, though. Bernie Sanders calls this disparity between the Waltons and their rank-and-file employees, in terms of wealth, obscene. The argument that they cannot pay a living wage, well, you can draw your own conclusion. Walmart is the proverbial welfare queen of big business. Only one of several big corporations in this country living in part on the public dole. Joseph Stiglitz, that I referred to a moment ago in the meditation reading, has addressed, I think, in powerful ways the issues of inequality related to the tax code and the decline of the middle class and growing poverty, all of which he is convinced, and he makes a good argument for it, threaten the future of our very democracy. His argument is that we are out of control. Inequality, this wide disparity of wealth, moved front and center in the last presidential campaign with Romney's now infamous comment about the 37% considering them themselves victims, and he referred to them as freeloaders, takers from the public dole. Stiglitz says, the irony, of course, is that people like Romney are the true freeloaders. The taxes that he said he was paying at a 14% level are far less than most people with substantially less income. Stiglitz goes on to suggest several misunderstandings that we all have, probably, about how the tax code works. First, those who don't pay any income tax do pay a host of other taxes, sales tax, payroll tax, excise tax, and in many instances, property taxes. Second, those receiving benefits of various kinds have paid for them already up front in programs like Social Security and Medicare contributions. They are not freeloaders. Stiglitz continues, many persons at the bottom are there partly because government has failed in one way or another. It has failed to provide them with the skills that would make them productive, so that they could earn an adequate living. It has failed to stop banks from taking advantage of them through predatory lending and current credit card practices. It has failed to stop for-profit schools from taking advantage of their aspirations to move up in the world. And it has failed to manage an overall economy in a way that sustains full employment. Another inequality needs to be highlighted here that we don't often talk about, and that is that the government spends four times as much, through the tax code again, subsidizing housing for the richest in our country through our tax system, as it does on public housing for the poor. As you all know, or those of you who know me, my religious roots, are in the Jewish Christian tradition. I consider myself to be a bit in exile. I can explain that sometime. But further than that, my roots are in the strong prophetic tradition of Isaiah and Jeremiah and the minor prophets like Micah, and particularly Amos. And it has always seemed to me that when the church, or in this case a congregation, forgets what its roots are and leaves behind its prophetic tradition, its effectiveness is finished. For virtually all of the social movements of our American history have had a prophetic thrust and witness, almost without exception. Righteous discontent, which is the new term that I learned from Carl a few days ago, righteous discontent is something that has become imperative at some point. Anger, yes, I would say anger that is constructive is the order of the day. When I preached for Carl a couple of weeks ago, and he had said to me, dig out an old sermon. And I didn't do that, as you know. But there is one old sermon that I did try to find, and it used the prophet Amos, and the title of it was Get Angry. Well, I couldn't find it, but I'm angry anyway, so it doesn't matter. Anyway, the issue, I think, is that there has always been a tension in our American system between individual rights and community rights, or should I say self-interest. And there is an ebb and flow to this. I think during the Roosevelt era, particularly the response to the Depression, was to take community interests very, very seriously. That has changed dramatically, and we are in an era of self-interest when it probably needs to be on community again. And the question, you see, is what kind of community do we want to live in? Is it one where virtually everybody has at least enough? Should that not be a goal in and of itself? Have not communities at their best always helped those less fortunate? If a system leads to high unemployment or to jobs that pay so little that survival becomes an issue for those holding those jobs down, and single mothers with many children are in poverty, leading to a dependency on food stamps, then isn't there something wrong with that system? Stiglitz makes a reference to Alexis de Tocqueville, who spoke during a visit to this country of the genius of our folk for, quote, self-interest properly understood. It's a good quote to remember. Self-interest properly understood. It's the properly understood portion of that that is important. It's the key. It means, says Tocqueville, appreciating that paying attention to everyone else's self-interest, in other words, to the common welfare, is in fact a precondition for one's ultimate well-being. Tocqueville understood something very basic about human nature, and it is that looking out for the needs of others is not simply good for the soul, it is good business as well. There are those, and I am one of them, who are anxious for a renewal of a vision of life in American society where poverty is not the norm, but where it is rare, and where the gap between the haves and the have-nots is narrowed from what is now obscene, in the words of Bernie Sanders, to something that at least points toward fairness and justice. We need a shared destiny, a common commitment to opportunity and fairness, where the words liberty and justice for all actually mean something nearer to what they seem to say, where we take seriously the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which emphasizes the importance not only of civil rights, but of economic rights, and not just the rights of property, but economic rights of ordinary citizens.